Hi, I'm Susanna Walters, and welcome to Ask a Feminist, a podcast from Signs, Journal of Women in Culture and Society. On this podcast, we actually ask feminists about the pressing issues of the day to provide the kind of feminist analysis and context that is often missing in mainstream coverage. We are back after a long hiatus with an episode on the current state of public feminism. I'm joined by the wonderful Andy Zeisler and equally wonderful Marcy Bianco to talk through some of the dilemmas facing those of us who want feminist writing to reach as wide an audience as possible. Andy is the co-founder of Bitch Media and the author of We Were Feminists Once, From Riot Girl to Cover Girl. And Marcy is the author of Breaking Free, The Lie of Equality and the Feminist Fight for Freedom. Her feminist and cultural criticism has been published widely in both mainstream outlets and independent feminist and LGBTQ outlets. Their experiences writing for feminist publics and building feminist platforms give them unique insights into the difficulties faced by those trying to reach or create feminist publics today. We talk about the problem of turning feminism into part of one's personal brand, for example, and the pitfalls of electing a few individuals as the public representatives of a movement as broad and diverse as feminism. It's a great conversation. Enjoy. We're here with Andy Zeisler and Marcy Bianco to talk about public feminism. And of course, so the first question is the obvious one, which is, do you consider yourself a public feminist? What does that phrase mean? I mean, I've been using this phrase. I kind of have an idea of what I think it means. But of course, I want to know, is this a self-identity that you have? What does it mean to you? And how did you end up? How did you get into the racket, the public feminism racket? So let me start with you, Andy.
Yeah, the very lucrative, as we know, public feminism racket. Yeah. Like all of us, I got in it for the money, you know. I don't want to say it was accidental, but so my route into media criticism with a feminist bent came through the magazine that I co-founded back in 1996 with two friends. And, you know, when I think about it now, it was a public feminist project in the sense that what we really wanted to do was take a lot of the incredibly sort of visionary, transformative feminism that we had learned in explicitly feminist spaces, you know, college, university, books, things like that, and sort of take it into the mainstream. Because at that time, and this was like, you know, at the dawn of the internet, there was not a lot of public feminism. There was academic feminism, and there was, you know, a handful of like feminist publications, you know, Ms. being the most prominent. But there wasn't a lot in between there. And our feeling was this stuff is very relevant, especially because popular culture is where most people get their ideas about what feminism is, why gender matters, power dynamics, all of the things that are part of feminist conversations. So our feeling was that we want to be kind of the conduit for making feminism accessible to as many people as possible and sort of connecting the dots between longstanding movement ideas and political ideologies to show how media and popular culture sort of reflect those out to the world.
What about you, Marcy?
So there are some similarities in my journey in relation to Andy. I think the rise of the internet at that time in the late aughts in early 2010s when it was more the internet was more democratized, really facilitated my move into a kind of more public realm. But my story is, I don't know, I always say it's a bit more romanticized because it begins in academia. And I mean, to be quite honest, it begins with someone who I idolized, who was a professor of mine and who I worked for a long time. And her name is Marjorie Garber, and she's a Shakespearean. And in 2001, The Nation published an article on her called Marjorie Garber, PI. And I said, public, meaning public intellectual. And I said, oh, that's what I want to be when I grow up. You know, I want to be dazzling and sexy and speak to, have intelligent thoughts and ideas, and speak to a larger public and really help shape public discourse, because I really believe ideas are the foundation for our actions, our policies, everything that we do. I really believe that. And you know, the funny thing is, as I moved through academia and I studied Renaissance drama, you know, to be a kind of acolyte in her mold, I realized I wanted to speak to a broader audience. So for me, it's, you know, the public part of that is about speaking to, it's really performative, like you were speaking to who you want to speak to. At the same time, what I realized, and this is something that bell hooks spoke about in Signs in a 1997 interview with Tanya McKinnon. She was talking about her work and how it was written to share feminist ideas and a feminist sensibility to a larger audience, right? Outside of a very privatized academic setting. But she noted, and I feel like this is really critical, like, you know, it's not the person who determines if they're a public intellectual or a public feminist. It's really for her, and she was speaking specifically about a public intellectual, it's how an audience embraces and uses your work. And they really end up, you know, like identifying you or your body of work as a public intellectual. And I really like that definition because it decenters the individual, right? Especially in today's world where I feel like the most mainstream forms of feminism are really based in like the individual and the branding and people selling shit online, which I find to be really disgusting. And Andy's actually like made that the subject of her book. And instead focuses on the body of work, which creates a longer temporality. You know, bell hooks' work, I feel like, is more powerful and prescient than ever before, and people are engaging with her work. And so it's really the body of work that is the stand-in for the public intellectual. And I just love, I love that definition.
I think you're right in the best sense of a public feminism or public intellectual more broadly. It isn't the individual, it's the way in which that individual is a sort of conduit for a broader kind of collective understanding and need and desire for a community. But now we have a world in which people are, and feminists are from the get-go, starting this self-branding process and beginning their careers as self-defined public feminists, and you know, both from within academia and from without academia, from outside academia. And I wonder what you all think about that tension between a sort of self-branding that is immediately commodified. I mean, it doesn't become commodified. It is the commodity form. That self-branding and that sort of older, more romanticized, or more egalitarian, more collective ethos of a public feminist as being a conduit, as being a you know, a not an individual in that sense, but a collective, you know, expressing a collective voice in some way. I wonder if you both could speak to that a bit, because it's some it is the moment we're very much in, I think.
Yeah, so I actually don't really romanticize the idea of the feminist public intellectual community, because I think one of the things we talked about a lot when we started Bitch, and one of the things we actually wrote about quite a bit, was the the way that movements are split from outside when a single figure becomes sort of anointed. And so during like the second wave, for instance, you know, there was so much, there were multiple feminisms. There was so, you know, it was not a monolithic movement. But because the mainstream media glommed on to just a very, very small handful of figures and sort of anointed them, that caused rifts within the community because it was really elevating certain personalities and certain issues over others. And so, you know, we got a very limited view of what feminist issues were. They were generally tied to sort of middle class white women's issues and weren't, even though that's not what feminism on the ground looked like, that was sort of the image that was cemented in the cultural imagination. So, you know, that was something we were really mindful of. And so for that reason, we didn't think of other feminist magazines as like our competition. We weren't thinking about like market share. We were thinking about a rising tide that lifts all boats. And the more feminist media there would be, like if the more feminist media there was, the less each of us would have to be everything to everyone. And I think that's really important. I think what we have now is a lot of, as you said, self-described public feminists, but very, very few public feminist spaces. And I think that's a big part of it, is sort of being in community, having a multiplicity of voices, and not pushing down individual personalities, but really understanding how individuals can reach certain audiences with certain ideas, but also connect the dots and draw them back to the sort of larger discourse of feminism. And
that's such an important point because, you know, I mean, one of the reasons Bitch was so important, I think, is that it was this internal and external conversation. It felt conversational. You know, it felt engaged in community building as a site. So we have this phenomenon now where there had never been so many feminist public intellectuals, right? Feminism is, you know, whether it's the gender editor at the New York Times or the, you know, I mean, it is all over in popular discourse, in mainstream news coverage, in mainstream television to some extent, you know, so it's more present, but feminist spaces for that conversation have diminished drastically. And so it's this weird, you know, phenomenon.
Yeah, I feel like Andy is right on the nose to identify the landscape in terms of the kind of complete denigration of those feminist spaces, whether they were blog sites or websites. I mean, like places where we could build community and be in discussion with each other and also allow that discussion to kind of seep or filter into a broader kind of public sphere. I mean, I felt that personally, having worked in really like marginalized media, whether like lesbian media, queer media, feminist media, since 2007, when I began contributing to what was then the Feminist Review, which was like a cultural reviews, book reviews website. Most of these websites have completely shut down. And so we don't know where to go. And what has happened too with the rise of social media, there's a continued atomization of the collective. So of course, like, I love that people are identifying as feminists. Like, I want to make that perfectly clear. Like, I love that. I love feminist sensibility. I want that conversation to really thrive, but I don't know with the current state of how social media operates, in which the algorithm really informs who is seen and what is seen. I don't know if we will actually be able to advocate for those really radical feminist ideas in a way that can circumnavigate certain algorithms, which, you know, I think the social of social media really demands conformity in order to get eyeballs, right? Like you have to play the game.
So one question I have is, how do you see sort of public feminism changing over time? I mean, when we think back to figures who wouldn't, we might not have defined them, or they define themselves as public feminists, but, you know, Germaine Greer, Gloria Steinem, Kate Millett, bell hooks, Andrea Dworkin, back further, Mary Wollstonecraft, you know, Simone de Beauvoir, whose works and ideas had a public reverberation, right? Even though they didn't have the platforms that we now think of as public spaces, social media, right? Or our own magazines or whatever. Because there always has been, you know, there have been public feminists in that way. But how do you think that shift, you know, how would you analyze that shift from that, from earlier generations to this generation that is marked, as we're saying, by, you know, both the more presence of feminists in the public sphere and in the, you know, sort of civic life in that way, by social media evisceration of anything that's not social media, right? And the decline of the institutional spaces, like Bitch Magazine, you know, decline of those kinds of places where we had those internal conversations. At the same time, the rise of feminism as an intellectual enterprise in the academy. So you have these countervailing, you know, it's not a clear linear, it's a complicated movement, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. And I'm interested in what you both think about some of those larger shifts when you look back at some of our great foremothers.
Yeah, I mean, I think the most obvious one and the most obvious change from then to now, and one that's actually been, you know, pretty monumental and pretty recent, is just the shifting of what feminism is for. And I think social media in particular, and the rise of a very widespread social media fed pop feminism, is that it chips away at feminism as a sort of transformative social movement, as an ideology, and makes it increasingly about feminism as a metric of whether something is okay to consume, whether something is laudable, whether something is worthwhile to spend your money on. It's less about using feminism as a lens, as a worldview, and more about feminism as a kind of value judgment, and in many ways, a consumer cudgel, a way to say, don't watch this, it's not feminist. Don't buy that, it's not feminist. I think there's, you know, it's very, very hard to talk about feminism now without, as Marcy brought up, talking about the sort of individualist personal branding that is sort of the goal, or that, you know, maybe that's unfair, that seems to be the goal of a lot of public feminists. I think, you know, without idolizing or romanticizing the past, you know, I think feminism has always been an ideology that needed to get out there. And the work of feminism in so many ways has always been about justifying its own existence. And that's unfortunate, because so much of the possibility of feminist thought and feminist action is just really hamstrung by the fact that every public feminist, since there have been public feminists, has been tasked with justifying why they're speaking out, why they're talking, what, you know, whether they have anything to say, whether anyone's going to listen. And so much of the work of feminism has simply been struggling to convince other people that feminism is needed to begin with. And so much of the potential transformative work ends up kind of falling by the wayside. And then the next public feminist who is anointed has to start that work all over again. So in many ways, it's a, you know, sort of two steps forward, one step back, or one step forward, two steps back, depending on how, you know, sort of pessimistic I'm feeling. it's a dynamic that has not really allowed for much forward movement because the larger world is so resistant to the very idea of it.
I want to get back to the academic, because I did want to ask you all about that. The sort of, you know, that's always been a big divide within feminism, or at least it's presented as a big divide. I'm not actually sure how huge a divide it really is in actual feminist lives, but okay, for the moment, is this activism, academia, public, you know, the public and the scholarly, those, you know, that sense of there being really two discrete worlds. And the irony is, of course, that so many of contemporary public feminists have a foothold in both and really do start this sort of branding of themselves as public intellectual feminists very early in their careers. I mean, I see it all the time with young feminist scholars. I'm like, wow, girl, go ahead. But, you know, it's quite amazing to watch this sort of process, because for my generation, of course, you know, it was just no thought that the public would be in any way embracing of anything we had to say. You know, it was just presumed that, you know, feminism was antithetical to, you know, mainstream media because of its radicalism. But now that has changed. And yet we still have this sort of understanding of these as separate worlds and in some contestation. Why do you think that is? Why does that narrative still hold so much?
I feel like this contestation is really about policing boundaries in large part. And academia has really changed in the last 20 years. When I decided to step out and not follow that career path, right? And this is around 2011, because I, again, wanted to have a broader conversation. I had studied Renaissance drama, Christopher Marlowe, and I was like, I want to speak more to like 20 people. I want my work to mean something in this world. I mean, no offense, like I still want to write on Marlowe someday, but there was a very specific and very kind of strict pathway to a kind of tenured life that was still probable at the turn of the century. You know, we still believe that tenured positions existed. These days, I still, you know, work in academia, but on the margins. I'm a staff member, I'm an editor, and I often speak to graduate students, and I work with grad students, early career professionals, you know, mid-career, and I, you know, edit texts from tenured professors as well. Everyone is trying to parlay their work into a more public kind of, for a more public audience. Like, that has become part of the academic trajectory, whereas before, the recipe was establish yourself in the field, get tenure, publish two books, and maybe your third book, you know, can be that public book, you know, a la Marjorie Garber, vested interests. These days it's different. I get a lot of graduate students coming to me saying, how do I translate my academic work for a broader audience? I feel like that's a product of several things. One, the complete denigration of the humanities, the decline of roles in the humanities, jobs in the humanities.
Right.
And this, you know, a larger desire to find connection to the outside world and find meaning of one's work in the outside world, when I feel like, at least especially in America, working in the humanities is seen as valueless or kind of not worthy of investment, when in fact we give everyone the ideas, the tools, the frameworks, the discourses to live their lives and create ethics to live their lives. So it's changed a lot.
It's changed enormously. I think you put your finger on it. I mean, you know, I see it certainly that people are really Beginning their careers, feminist, I mean, that's all I work with, feminist scholars who are beginning their careers thinking, how can I make this accessible? How can I make this public? With the sort of marketing edge and branding edge to it, too. And for my generation, of course, you know, I was, in fact, penalized because my work was more public. It was like, why are you being reviewed in newspapers? That's terrible. You know, that's not where, I mean, it was really told to me. So that's shifted. So my question then, the follow-up is, you know, has that resulted in a sort of denigration or an enhancement of the public sphere of feminism in that way? I mean, here we have these, you know, these sort of mixed phenomenon, right, of academics, scholarly feminists who are now being more public, right? And trying to, at least trying to be more accessible. And of course, this was just marked by Judith Butler, you know, having a book that was, you know, their first attempt to really do a very clear, you know, very clear sense of it, really do a public book, you know, to change the discourse, to lay it out. How much it succeeds is an open question, but it certainly is out there in the world in that, with that desire. And, you know, so, and then we have all of these sort of individual public feminist figures who speak in our name in some way. Are we left with a richer public sphere that has a more diverse, interesting, nuanced, substantive array of feminist voices?
Yeah, I mean, just to get back to the question before about the way the interaction of academic feminism and more public feminism, you know, my generation, I think there was really a bright line between academic feminism and public feminism that really came down to activism. And I was never in academia, but I worked with a lot of writers who were trying to kind of straddle the line between academic writing and writing for a broader public and making their ideas accessible and sort of, you know, being able to function in two places. The sense I got from them often explicitly was that academia really prized a kind of objective distance, and activism was kind of seen to mar that in a way, that actually engaging in feminist activism would possibly discredit their work or make it less estimable, I guess. And at least a few of them that I know of ended up leaving academia because they felt really constrained in terms of what kind of visible activism they could be doing. I mean, I think, as Marcy said, we're in a period of like a kind of toxic populism where there's a real distrust and denigration of the humanities. But beyond that, distrust of anyone who has a specific, specialized kind of expertise. The belief that only the ostensibly unbiased person should be listened to is something that has really taken hold and really infected so many things, from, you know, this kind of overweening focus on the undecided voter to the idea that people who have experienced things like institutional racism or sexual harassment or rape are unqualified to be public voices because they have too much skin in the game. There's very much still this this reverence for the supposed objective distance of the omniscient white male narrator. And so much of what that ends up looking like is a sort of habitual mistrust of anyone who knows too much about a certain subject, who has too much experience combined with education or expertise or training.
Oh my God, Andy, I love everything that you're saying.
Me too. We so all subtle, agree.
It also... Because it makes me think, okay, is public feminism getting richer? In some ways, yes, right? When we think about more people entering this public field, we get more diversity of perspective, whether or not, that diversity of voice or perspective is given a audience or a huge platform. But, you know, like thinking about people who have come out of academia or who have connections to academia, Melissa Murray, Roxane Gay, Brittany Cooper, these are all people who I revere. For me, the public is really defined by access and circulation. For me, circulation is really tied to temporality. And to Andy's point specifically about the denigration of expertise, I feel like this is the biggest challenge for the movement forward in public feminism, because it's been primarily online. The temporality of social media is rapid. There's, you know, a waterfall of content that we can barely grasp onto things. And what is lost in that is the history of, you know, what has come before all those feminist voices who, frankly, who have said everything we've already said.
Yeah, now I have to agree with that. But part of it is, you know, you all have mentioned it many times, and I think you're right, that the evisceration of those feminist institutional spaces. So we have, you know, we have Ms. still, we have women's media. It's not that there's nothing, but they are, you know, they're looking more and more mainstream. They don't, you know, they're not as conversational in the way in which, I mean, I have to always go back to Bitch, because I think it did have, there was a model there of a kind of collectivity and an internal discourse that was always externally focused. And I don't know how we, I mean, this is for you younger people, but how we begin to build those again, because I do think, that this sort of atomization of, you know, individual, acceptable, male-identified, you know, feminists is a problem that is not up to the task before us.
Well, and Andy, could I ask?
Yeah, go ahead.
Wanted to ask you, I mean, this is your career, this is your expertise. We need literal spaces, even if they're spaces of a magazine book, right? But what has happened, and I'm wondering if you, what your take on this is that because we don't have feminist spaces, magazines, really prominent blog sites anymore, really, to the extent that we used to, what has happened is that these public feminists have tried to seek publication or acceptance into mainstream media. And as a result, I feel like there's a lot of infighting, because we know there's only one space for one gender person at the New York Times, and we don't lift each other up. I'm wondering how you see it coming from your actual vantage point.
I think it's a huge loss, and I think, you know, what it really speaks to, and what, you know, I think everyone knows but is really always been the elephant in the room, is that feminism is fundamentally incompatible with capitalism. And so when every feminist project has to not only justify itself sort of ideologically and content-wise, but somehow make money, it's incredibly difficult. The single biggest problem for Bitch was always funding. I mean, the right amount of money that we saw going into, you know, sort of venture capital backed feminist sites, like Bustle is a great example. It's very frustrating because, and even with women venture capitalists, like the ones who backed the Establishment, that short-lived feminist site, these were people who didn't want to fund existing projects. They wanted to make something that they put their name on and put their flag in the ground as a feminist site, because the idea was that women, and feminist women in particular, were an untapped market that could return an investment without sort of really engaging with the idea that feminism as a transformative social movement was never meant to be profitable. You know what I mean? Like, it just wasn't. And I think, unfortunately, that has been something that is simply almost impossible for sort of collective feminist media projects to reckon with. Because, what happens there, what happens when you really need money to function, is you're going to be appealing to people who aren't really looking at the ideas, they're looking at the marketability. And, you know, that comes back to the fact that most people do not want feminism to exist. It is a incredibly inconvenient social movement. It challenges everything. And so, you know.
I love that. That's a perfect phrase. An inconvenient movement.
It's very inconvenient.
Yeah, it's just, you know, people act like the lack of funding is a bug and not a feature. You know, it's obviously very dispiriting to me as someone who feels like, you know, the most radical feminist work is done in community. It doesn't come from one voice. It doesn't come from one person. It comes from conversations. It comes from disagreements. It comes from, you know, the belief that we have to stand together even if we don't always agree. And so what we have now is, you know, certainly a media realm where there's a multiplicity of feminist voices, but you still have ones that are platformed much higher than others, and those are the ones that tend to be working for corporate media, media that is really not invested in progressivism, whatever their sort of public attitude. It's frustrating. And then even when you look at some of the platforms where feminists do have a voice and feminists are, you know, essentially self-funding their own work, these are platforms that could go away at any moment. You know, Substack could fold. I mean, it probably won't, but I'm saying big tech's infiltration of media and its big tech sort of branding as like independent right. media is really not a sustainable way for feminist media to develop, to be reinvigorated.
The two fields or the two industries we're talking about, media and academia, it's like we sure really did pick winners, you know?
Yeah, they're both in great shape these days. Like, yeah, wow, no problem there.
What are the alternatives?
Like, you know, tech, could we all be tech bros? I mean, what, you know, that's not going to happen.
Lord, no, I'm not wearing khakis, no.
That's a good note to end on. None of us will ever wear khakis. Listen, you guys, I could talk with you guys forever. It's been absolutely fabulous. One thing we're leaving with, both the darkness of the moment. I mean, there's no way to not think of that. But also that there are, you know, because so many more people are thinking and doing feminism in some form, there is a potential to reimagine, I think. The question is, where does that sit? Physically, where does that sit? Spatially, temporally? I think that's part of the question, you know, to take it away from those individual moments and be able to have conversations like these. I mean, to me, this is so much more interesting than hearing me go on or you go on. You know, it's about an interaction. And I think that's what seems to me so missing when you have the anointed individual who is you know, getting a platform.
Thanks so much again to Andy Zeisler and Marcy Bianco for this wonderful conversation. Please consider subscribing to the podcast and leaving us a review. Ask a Feminist is part of a larger project we're doing at Signs called the Feminist Public Intellectuals Project, which is all available for free on our website at signsjournal.org. You can find tons of fabulous free feminist content there, including our Short Takes series, where we offer commentaries on feminist books, most recently, Judith Butler's Who's Afraid of Gender. We also have a series called Feminist Frictions, which has essays on controversial topics like trigger warnings and identity politics. And you can find us on Twitter, or I guess it's called X, and Facebook at Signs Journal. I'm Susanna Walters, editor of Signs. Thanks for listening, and stay feminist.